Fracking for natural gas is now a well-established industry in our region, but the business model might not be as stable as it seems.
What happens if the financial environment changes and Wall Street stops funding these companies? What happens to the American fracking revolution?
I'm Carol Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the shaky economics of fracking. And there could be changes to how pollution is regulated on the Ohio River.
Your technical people and your commissioners have been approving these standards for decades. Are you now telling me that you believe that they're suitable and appropriate for the river, but you're not using them?
Plus, a winter sport that takes skill, grace, and a little bit of rebellion.
You learn all the rules on how to ski properly, and then you break them.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pennsylvania lawmakers are taking the first steps towards introducing legislation aimed at bailing out Pennsylvania's nuclear power industry. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more.
Lawmakers are expected to introduce a bill later this session, but a co-sponsorship memo circulated this week provides a first look at what it might contain. Representative Thomas Mahaffey and Senator Ryan Aument, both Republicans from Central Pennsylvania, are asking their colleagues to join them in supporting forthcoming legislation to amend Pennsylvania's Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard. It's a law requiring utilities to buy portions of their electricity from clean and alternative sources. Right now, it doesn't include nuclear energy. Mahaffey and Aument want to change that. They're concerned because both the Three Mile Island nuclear plant near Harrisburg and the Beaver Valley plant outside Pittsburgh will close before their licenses expire unless the state steps in. It's part of a broader trend across the U.S. as the industry has struggled amid slowing demand for electricity and competition from cheaper natural gas and renewables. The bailout is opposed by consumer groups like the AARP, which says it will hurt ratepayers, as well as industrial energy consumers and Pennsylvania's natural gas industry. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
In the first week of February, many in the Pittsburgh region received unhealthy air warnings with the weather forecasts on their smartphones. A code orange air quality alert was issued for 20 Pennsylvania counties, including Allegheny County. According to the state's Department of Environmental Protection, the increased pollution was due to higher levels of fine particulate pollution, small particles that can be inhaled and cause health problems, especially for sensitive groups like children, the elderly, and people with asthma.
The issue is particularly acute in the Mon Valley, but it affects all of the air in Allegheny County. And this is just an unfortunate piling on of issues.
Matt Mihalik with the Breathe Project says particularly poor air quality in Clairton, south of Pittsburgh, could have been made worse by December's fire at U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works. The fire damaged pollution controls there. But another issue was the weather. Fred McMullen, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Pittsburgh, says an inversion was partly to blame.
Typically in the atmosphere, temperatures cool as you go up higher in the sky. An inversion occurs when temperatures actually increase with height.
He says it acts like a lid.
You know, you boil water on a stovetop, you put the lid on top to kind of keep the water in there. That's what an inversion does. So the air that happens, like all the stuff that happens on the ground, because the temperature increases with height, it can't exceed that, so it puts a cap on it. If you're looking at cooling stacks like on power plants, there's a nice big column of vertical air that goes up in the sky. So you can tell when their inversion is in place by looking at the moisture off the cooling towers. If it goes horizontally, then there's an inversion in place.
McMullen says inversions often happen when cool, clear nights are followed by a front of warmer air. Typically, they dissipate over the course of a day, and they aren't uncommon this time of year. But sometimes they stick around. During air quality alerts, the state asks people to limit driving and to refuel vehicles after dusk to help reduce air pollution. And in Erie County, the Pennsylvania DEP has ordered Erie Coke to address ongoing violations of air pollution rules at its Coke plant near Presque Isle Bay. In a press release, the agency said it has not detected exceedances of ambient air quality standards at its monitors in the area, but that it will continue to investigate. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsoppel. The Ohio River provides drinking water for more than 5 million people. A multi-state commission charged with ensuring water quality in the river will consider whether to eliminate its pollution control standards on Thursday. Thousands of people have expressed opposition. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that others say one reason to drop the standards is that some states never even adopted them.
This all started 5 years ago when Dayton Power and Light, along with a handful of energy companies, challenged the state of Ohio. They said the state permits could not use a standard set by the Ohio River Valley Sanitation Commission, known as ORSANCO, that limits the temperature of the company's waste discharges into the Ohio River. That's because the state had never officially adopted the ORSANCO standards into Ohio law, and the companies won.
It was a shock.
Tom Fitzgerald is an ORSANCO commissioner. Each of the 8 Ohio River states has 2 or 3 commissioners on the board. I caught up with Fitzgerald by phone on his way to the Kentucky legislature, where he lobbies on environmental issues. On ORSANCO, he's considered a federal commissioner.
Yeah, I'm one of the 3 federal commissioners that were appointed by President Obama. So I guess I'm a holdover.
ORSANCO is a compact between the Ohio River states that dates back to 1948, before the Federal Clean Water Act, before states had their own water quality standards. Through the decades, the experts at ORSANCO have created rules and standards for all kinds of discharges into the river, like specific limits on chemicals such as benzene and mercury to protect aquatic life and human health. What came to light in that 2014 case was that while some states in the compact, like Pennsylvania and Indiana, have adopted the ORSANCO standards to protect water quality, others, like Ohio and Illinois, have not.
Your technical people and your commissioners have been approving these standards for decades. Are you now telling me that you believe that they're suitable and appropriate for the river, but you're not using them?
Fitzgerald says this disparity impacts water quality and creates an unfair playing field for industries in the different river states. For instance, states that have adopted ORSANCO regulations, like Pennsylvania, limit some mercury discharges into the river, while Illinois does not. Toby Frevert is an ORSANCO commissioner from Illinois and chair of its Pollution Control Standards Committee. His state has its own pollution control board, and he says ORSANCO has no legal authority.
They don't have the luxury of delegating that off to an interstate commission or anybody else. They have to adopt the regulations that the administrative agency is bound to operate by.
Prevert says states are required to work with the U.S. EPA to meet federal water quality standards, and there's no longer a need for ORSANCO as a pollution regulator.
In my opinion, ORSANCO is a great organization. I love it. But it was really not designed or staffed to handle regulations in the modern era the way U.S. EPA and the state environmental agencies are.
But one analysis by ORSANCO found 188 instances where ORSANCO regulates pollution and the U.S. EPA does not or is less stringent. Tom Fitzgerald, the federal commissioner in Kentucky, looks at the current rollback of federal environmental regulations and says states that care about the health of the Ohio River should maintain ORSANCO protections.
Even if the Clean Water Act itself is in turmoil, this is not the time. Signal of retreat.
ORSANCO received well over 5,000 public comments on its proposal, most of them opposed to eliminating the pollution control standards. The commission is scheduled to vote February 14th, but many expect it will be delayed as the board considers revisions. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Imagine your dad on skis and the center of attention as he whooshes by.
We always kind of knew where he was on the slopes also because we could hear people ooing and aahing.
Later on the Allegheny Front, one family and their tradition of ski ballet. That's coming up. President Trump delivered his second State of the Union address, briefly highlighting a favorite theme, energy dominance.
And we have unleashed a revolution in American energy. The United States is now the number one producer of oil and natural gas anywhere in the world.
The idea is that America will produce all of the energy it needs and will export more energy, like liquefied natural gas, to increase its influence on world politics. The Trump administration plans to auction off millions of acres of public land in the West for oil and gas development, including fracking. While many have focused on the environmental impacts of fracking, how it affects our drinking water, our health, and the climate, Journalist Bethany McLean looks at the financial side of the industry in her book, Saudi America: The Truth About Fracking and How It's Changing the World. For the State Impact Pennsylvania podcast, Energy Explained, Susan Phillips talks with McLean about her book.
I've covered fracking here in Pennsylvania for about 7 years, and one of my first stories actually was about Chesapeake Energy, which did a lot of drilling early on in Northeast Pennsylvania. And I remember going up there 2011, 2012, and Chesapeake was everywhere, funding new hospitals, and there were billboards promoting Chesapeake and its charitable activities.
We love the places we call home.
The people we call neighbors.
And it's our pledge.
And our privilege to make a difference.
And what's interesting to me is this book is basically a primer on Chesapeake Energy's evolution, and more importantly, its founder, Audrey McClendon. Can you tell me a little bit about McClendon and why you decided to focus your book on him?
I was fascinated with McClendon going back to around the time you started to cover fracking.
In the last few years, we've discovered the equivalent of two Saudi Arabias of oil in the form of natural gas in the United States. Not one, but two.
He's one of those larger-than-life characters that comes along every so often in the business world and literally proves that old adage, truth is stranger than fiction, over and over again.
Right.
And a source of mine used to tell me two things that piqued my interest. One was that Aubrey McClendon was the most important man in America. Obviously, there's a fair degree of hyperbole at work in that. But what he meant by that is that if McClendon was right and America had a really cheap supply of natural gas, that would change the type of industries that were located here. It would change America's economic future. But he and this guy and his partner would also have a debate. And his partner would say, the oil and gas are real. And my friend John would say, yeah, but the economics don't work. And so McClendon's Chesapeake is also the example of just how much cash these fracking enterprises can burn through and how financially weak they can be despite this idea that they are changing the world. That conundrum was really interesting to me.
A lot of people in Pennsylvania know Chesapeake because they hold a significant distinction among fracking companies here. Chesapeake actually billed leaseholders instead of paying them royalties when things started to go south for the company. And it's not mentioned in your book, but I'm just wondering if in your reporting you looked into that.
There were a lot of lawsuits all over the country, including in Texas, complaining about how Chesapeake treated them, particularly as the company fell on economically hard times. And I think that that story does tell the flip side of fracking. While it has helped people to make an enormous amount of money in some cases, landowners, and that has divided communities, there also is a cost to it if the enterprise itself falls on troubled times and doesn't eventually make money.
And that's what's so interesting is that, you know, the idea that they were making all this money and yet it was based on what your book describes as not a real solid foundation, that they weren't actually turning a profit, but there was a lot of money moving around. And I think that's what's hard for the average person to understand.
I think it's shocking. I think most people understand that fracking is environmentally contentious. I think they don't understand that it's financially contentious as well. And what I mean by that is that there's a battle on Wall Street, always has been, with short sellers, people who bet against stocks, saying these companies don't make money. The economics here don't work. And yet the amount of money, the sums are just so staggering. I calculated in the book that from the early 2000s through 2012, when McClendon was kicked out of Chesapeake, the company raised over $30 billion in debt and equity, paid Wall Street over $1 billion in fees. And that's not even to mention the other $30 billion plus that Chesapeake raised in more creative ways. The sums that have gone into the ground are just astonishing, and the sums that have been paid to Wall Street are astonishing.
And yet the sums that are paid to leaseholders, say, in places like Texas and Pennsylvania, are actually in the negative. They're actually sending bills to those folks.
Yeah, it's one of the things that actually has enabled fracking here to take off, unlike in other places around the world. And that is because people own their mineral rights and have been able to make money. And so some people have made money and others haven't.
Tell me what drove you to even get this idea to look into this.
Well, really, it was my obsession with Aubrey McClendon that made me want to write about this because he is just such a compelling character. But then, yes, this idea that this thing called fracking is reshaping the world. A source of mine says in the book it's one of the top five things reshaping geopolitics. It's having all these impacts around the globe. And yet the business model is really unstable. This industry as a whole has not proven yet that it can produce free cash flow. And so the key question to me is, what happens if the financial environment changes and Wall Street stops funding these companies? What happens to the American fracking revolution? How much oil and gas can these companies actually produce if they can only reinvest the cash flow they're producing and Wall Street stops sending them funds?
And that's in part because it costs so much relatively compared to other countries to get the oil or gas out of the ground.
It does. Well, it's a key distinction between fracking, so-called horizontal drilling combined with hydraulic fracturing and a traditional old vertical well. The decline rates on fracked wells are much higher, meaning that you'll get most of the oil and gas you're going to get in year one. In year two, you're going to produce significantly less. So if you're a company that needs to keep growing to show your investors that you're growing, you have to keep reinvesting in order to keep producing oil and gas. And so the thesis among those who are skeptical of the economic model is that companies will never be able to outrun the required reinvestment, that those numbers will always be so big that they will always, in effect, be operating like a Ponzi scheme where they need more capital from the outside in order to keep growing.
In Pennsylvania, obviously, we've been focusing our reporting on shale gas. And I realize a lot of what you discussed in the book is shale oil. How different are they? Is shale gas a little bit more stable in terms of its financial backing?
I think shale gas is really different than shale oil, and there are a couple of key distinctions. One is that fracking actually started with natural gas. It only moved to oil when the amount of fracked natural gas cratered the prices so much that nobody could make money anymore, which is part of what killed Chesapeake. But shale gas is, the decline rates are not as bad on the wells, and even at very low gas prices, there's an argument that it is more economically viable than shale oil is.
When you say the decline on the wells, you mean that over time, you know, the amount of gas coming out is not going to drop significantly like it does for oil.
Yes. The other really big difference with natural gas is that America actually, we do have a huge low-cost supply of natural gas. Let's put aside the question for the moment of whether that's a good or a bad thing for the environment. With oil, the picture is nowhere near as clear. So if you really wanted to make America energy independent, you would be actually more focused on natural gas than you would be on oil, and you would be converting our transportation infrastructure to natural gas as much as possible. Oil, it's much less clear both the economic viability of this, it's also much less clear how much of it we actually have that can be gotten out of the ground at prices that where anybody can make any money.
This begs the issue with your title, Saudi America. Somewhat ironic, I imagine. Talk to me about why you chose that title.
Right. Well, it is somewhat ironic because I came to believe through the course of reporting on the book that this whole concept of energy independence, even if we were producing a lot of oil and natural gas, was kind of a fraud. And what I mean by that is that American presidents going back to the 1970s have been talking about energy independence. It's become this grand concept that in modern years is completely unanchored to reality. Back in the 1970s, the Texas Railroad Commission could set the price of a barrel of oil. Today, the price of a barrel of oil is set by global markets, meaning the price that American consumers pay at the pump is going to be influenced by events in Libya and Nigeria and Venezuela, regardless of how much oil we're producing here. There's no such thing as energy independence. Even if we didn't need the Middle East's oil, our trading partners need it. So I came across this fascinating analysis that six of the top 10 sources of imports into the U.S., including goods we need for our high-tech industry to function, come from Asia, which is heavily dependent on Middle Eastern oil. And you'll notice in the wake of the horrible news about Jamal Khashoggi's killing and the possible implications for Saudi Arabia, you haven't heard anybody say, oh, look, American energy independence. We don't need Saudi Arabia. We can just walk away from all this.
It's such a global market at this point, and everyone's so interconnected. What about shale gas? I mean, what impact has that had on the global market for natural gas or liquid natural gas, liquefied natural gas?
It's a slightly complicated question because all of the infrastructure you need in order to transport natural gas has not been in place. So a lot of the impact that natural gas will have on global markets is sort of a TK to come. And you can see it starting to change things in these immense regasification facilities that are being built in Europe and the immense facilities that are being built here in order to transform natural gas into something that can be shipped and then regasified. And the idea is that it's really going to change geopolitics, particularly in Europe, because Europe has for decades relied heavily on Russia for its natural gas. And the idea is if the U.S. can import LNG into Europe, then Europe can free itself from its dependency on Russian natural gas. And that's going to have a huge impact in allowing Europe to negotiate better terms with Russia and allowing Europe some degree of freedom and flexibility from Russia. That has yet to play out because the necessary infrastructure, particularly in Europe, from the regasification plants to the pipelines, isn't in place yet. On our shores, you can see the impact it's having with the petrochemical facilities that are going up. You know, that side of the predictions about McClendon, that it would change the type of industry that's located in the U.S., is happening in spades, which is questionable from an environmental standpoint, but at least from a short-term economic standpoint, probably a benefit to the U.S.
In the process of doing this book, and of course you had a business perspective, that's what you were looking at. Did anything else come up that made you change your mind on something or surprise you in any way?
So the book is not an environmental book, in part because it is a mini book. And in order to make it work in short format, I had to really have a laser-like focus on what I was going to write about. But in the course of reporting this book, people said, you should talk to Charlie Munger. And Charlie Munger is Warren Buffett's famous 90-something-year-old sidekick, still as sharp as ever. And if you get a chance to talk to Charlie Munger about something, you should probably talk to him, right?
Right.
So Charlie is obsessed with this issue. And there's a link between the financial instability and the conservation argument. And what he pointed out was that there's still no substitute in many areas of modern life, and most importantly, fertilizers that we need to feed our population for hydrocarbons. And so essentially, what are we doing, sucking all this stuff out of the ground at prices where companies don't even make any money and leaving ourselves perhaps with no supply for that proverbial rainy day later? If we were being smart, we would use this slowly as we could. That it's like the topsoil of Iowa. You should use it as slowly as you can, not as quickly as you can. And that argument really resonated with me. I think also what I was surprised by were the number of smart investors who are no longer investing in oil and gas because they think the age of renewables will be here sooner than later. And that's a whole huge controversial, fraught area. But it is interesting thought about through that lens that what are we doing beating our chests about American energy independence when, in effect, we're celebrating our leadership in the world as it was and perhaps neglecting our leadership in the world as it's going to be by allowing ourselves to fall behind in the race to develop renewables. And if that ultimately is the cost of the American fracking revolution, that we take our eye off the ball on renewables, I think the cost will be very high.
Bethany McLean is a journalist who's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine and the author of Saudi America, The Truth About Fracking and How It's Changing the World. She spoke with State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips for their podcast, Energy Explained. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University, celebrating over 25 years of preparing environmental professionals at both the undergraduate and graduate levels. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Featured programs include the Environmental Science and Management Master's Degree and Professional Certificate programs. Applications for the summer and fall semesters are now being accepted. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
Picture ballet, figure skating, and skiing all mashed into one. That's ski ballet, a mostly forgotten art form. It got a little bit of glory as a demonstration sport in the 1988 and 92 Olympic Games, But interest in it quickly waned when ski ballet didn't become a medal event. Though some called it a fad, on the slopes of Hidden Valley Resort, south of Pittsburgh, ski ballet is being kept alive by one very enthusiastic early adopter. Last winter, the Allegheny Front's Andy Kubis caught up with him.
It's hard to describe ski ballet until you've seen it.
Here comes George building up speed for his first big maneuver. Oh, a 2.5 stay cross. That was fabulous.
Picture a choreographed routine of flips, rolls, and twirls set to music while the skier glides down the slope in costume.
Would you look at those sleeves on his outfit? He is really one dramatic skier.
I saw it on television and I said, whoa, they're doing this on skis, and how do they do that?
This is Ed Cook, and when he saw ski ballet for the first time in 1976, he knew he had to try it. He went out and bought himself a pair of ballet skis, just a little shorter than a regular downhill pair, and it quickly became his passion.
I love the fact that I'm out here in fresh air on top of the snow, being able to twirl around and just get the thrill of it all. It's wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Now, 1 month shy of 67, you can find him most winter weekends on the slopes of the ski resort practicing his art, but in jeans, no costume.
The main thing is you learn all the rules on how to ski properly, and then you break them. What I do is I tend to lift my left leg and bring the ski up towards my shoulder, and then I will start to make 360s on the ground.
Cook starts to propel himself into a circle, using his poles to guide him. At one point, he's skiing backwards. It's surprising how often you see the bottom of his skis. He looks like a pinwheel.
And then at one point, I bring the tip of the ski back down, have the tip cross over my other ski, catch the snow, which will turn me again for a 360, and then I do a little bit of a kick out to get my skis parallel with each other again.
A kick out. That's his signature move, and he named it himself. Cook is entirely self-taught. He was never interested in competing. He just likes the challenge and energy that ski ballet brings him. He often skis with his kids and grandkids. And though his love of the art form hasn't rubbed off on any of them, his daughter, Zelina Cook, clearly admires him.
I think it's pretty cool. We always enjoyed watching him. We always kind of knew where he was on the slopes also because we could hear people oohing and aahing.
Cook does turn heads when he performs tricks, and it's obvious to everyone who sees him that he skis to the beat of his own drummer.
In the beginning, in particular, when I skied ballet, I would have music in my head that I started to move to the rhythm of it, and unlike typical balleting, it was always rock and roll that was going on in my head, but the slower paced rock and roll. Lady, I forget who sings that song even, but lady, you know, da-da-da. And that made the 360s a whole lot easier.
Lady, when you're with me, I'm smiling.
Nowadays, Cook doesn't ski ballet with a soundtrack in his head. He's just trying to get from one move to the next without falling.
The tricks just don't come as easily as they did when I was younger. But now at this point, I occasionally, what? I fell doing that stupid trick. That was a cinch normally.
Still, Cook is incredibly graceful. He says his dad skied well into his 80s, and Cook is hoping he'll be jumping and twirling just as long. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Kubis.
And we know you're going to want to watch some ski ballet videos after that. See Ed Cook and others in action at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. You can find those episodes at TrumpOnEarth.org. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.